All right, so thank you both for coming. So last week we went through the psukim of tzedakah. This week we're going to start getting into the actual sugyos and topics. In Shulchan Aruch, so Hilchos Tzedakah starts with Simin Reish Mem Zayin, 247. So the reason why we're not starting with that is because it's all agada. It's all homiletics about how good tzedakah is, how important it is to give, and how you should be happy when you give it. So we kind of talked about that last week. This next one, 248, is the first real topic. And the title of it is Mi Chayiv Ba Umi Ro'i Lekabla. So the title of that is who is obligated to give tzedakah and who is fitting or who should be receiving it. So what we're going to do is to read the first four pieces in Shulchan Aruch, which is going to be the topic of forcing people to donate tzedakah. In Hebrew, that's known as kofin al hatzedakah. So we're going to read the first four halachos in the Shulchan Aruch, and then once we have that, we're going to go back to the Gemara and see kind of where they get it from. So the Shulchan Aruch is in Hebrew. The Gemara I have both in Hebrew and in English. I photocopied from the Art Scroll. So let's start with the Shulchan Aruch. So it says, the Shulchan Aruch is in the middle. We're going to only be focusing on the middle of the text right now. Towards the end, we'll read the Vilna Gaon's commentary to kind of compare it to our analysis. But starting in the middle, from Sif Aleph, Kol Adam Chayev Litein Tzedakah. So every person is obligated to give tzedakah. Afilu Ani Hamisparneis Min Hatzedakah. Even a poor person that is supported by tzedakah, chayev liten mima sheyiten lo, is obligated to give tzedakah from what people give him. Umisha nosein pachos mima sheroi lo liten, and somebody who gives less than what he is ostensibly able to give, based in kofinoso, based in can force him, umakinoso, makas mardus, and can hit him with rabbinic Malkus, known as Malkus Mardus, like you're rebelling against Beis Din, ad sheyitein matcha amduhu liten, until he gives what they estimate that he can give. And even if that doesn't work, v'yarden l'nechasav, they can go down into his bank accounts. Now, so the Shulchan Aruch adds the word b'fanav. So we'll see that we're not going to get to that today. That's actually a debate, whether he needs to be there or not. Meaning, if he's in a coma or he's out of town or he ran away, can I just seize his assets? Or he doesn't want to come. Exactly. So can Beis Din just unilaterally decide to do it, or does he have to be there? That's a machlokes. The Shulchan Aruch says it has to be befanav, meaning he has to be there. V'lokchin mimenu masheroi litein, and they can take whatever they believe is fitting to take.
This sounds like a charter.
Exactly. Yes. No, this is pretty much what the IRS is. And it's important that you say that, because keep that in mind when we look at the Gemara as to where we get this from, because that's very important. So let's turn the page now. We'll do Sif Beis Gimel and Dalet. Sif Beis is not so important, but it says Memashkin al hatzedakah afilu be'erev Shabbos. We can take collateral from people that they should donate money to tzedakah, even on Erev Shabbos. The Mefarshim say that, like, what's so special about Erev Shabbos? Because people are busy. So the guy could basically say, I'll give after Shabbos. I don't have the time right now. I don't have the headspace. And Beis Din can say, no, we need the money now, so we're going to come in and take stuff now. So that's Beis. So now Gimel is where it gets a little bit interesting. So Yisomim, orphans, Ein poskin alehem tzedakah. We do not basically demand tzedakah from them. Afilu lepidyon shvuyin, even to redeem captives, which is considered to be some of the most important issues that tzedakah is needed for, to redeem captives. Afilu yesh lehem mamon harbi, even if they have a trust fund with a ton of money. Ella imkein poskin alehem lekavod sheyetze alehem shame, unless you believe that this will help them, it'll give them a good reputation if they'll get a plaque somewhere, and that'll help them, later on in life. And then the Rama adds a little bit, he qualifies it a little bit, basically saying if there's a set amount that they have, if they get like sort of like an allowance from the fund and then there's extra money, or if the captors are demanding a certain amount and it's not an unlimited, you know, in this unknown sum and you can take a little bit from them. He basically walks back this ruling, basically saying that like, if everybody can afford it and it's a set amount and they're good, so you can take a little bit.
But only you're talking about Yesomim.
Right, we're only talking about Yesomim. So we'll get to Dalet later. But if we put Aleph and Gimel together, so the first one says basically everybody's got to give, even a poor person. So what we said last week about what tzedakah is, whether it's a dinei mamonis, whether it's a financial thing, or whether it's like between you and God, or a iser v'heter type of thing. So why would an ani have to give? Why would a poor person have to give tzedakah?
Seems as though it's more of a mitzvah than just financial.
Exactly. So the Torah says that you have to give. The Torah says you have to give, so if you have what to give, even if you can only give a little bit, you have to give. So if that's the case, so how come orphans don't give then? Mm-hmm. So why?
Well, we're assuming that orphans are of a minor age.
Ah.
Hence, they don't have any, they don't really, if it's in a trust fund, so to speak, they don't have the jurisdiction to that fund.
Mm-hmm.
And as a minor, they have very few obligations at all.
Exactly. So,
wouldn't the apotropos?
So the way that finances worked for orphans during the times of the Gemara is assuming that there, you know, was no surviving, you know, parent. You know, mm-hmm. if the mother, then it gets a little bit interesting. Mm-hmm. But if assuming there was no mother or father, that's the simplest. So then the court appoints a custodian, either a relative or a non-relative, to oversee the finances of these orphans. That person had power of attorney with some limitations, but basically to cater to these orphans' best interests until they were old enough to be on their own. So the Gemara in Bava Basra, not where we're going to learn, but in the later Prakim, talks about what happens if the parents that died had debts to people. So paying back a debt is actually a mitzvah. If you borrow money, there is not only a financial obligation, but there's also a mitzvah that you need to pay back. You need to pay back what you borrowed. So now, when the father and mother die, so the estate is now under the auspices of an apotropos, a caretaker, on behalf of these minor orphans. So the Gemara asks, is the custodian supposed to take out money from the account to pay back the debt? And the Gemara says, generally no. The only exception is if the loan is to a non-Jew and there's interest that's accruing, so then it's in the orphan's best interest for you to just take the money out now and be done with it. Mm-hmm. But if it's to another Jew where there is no interest, so then you can't.
But the assumption would be then that the orphans will pay when they become of major age and
correct
access to the money.
Yes. So correct. So you can look at that in one of two ways. So you can look at it as if, okay, so we have a mitzvah, right? So there's a mitzvah not only on the person that borrowed the money, but on the estate. There's a mitzvah on the children to pay back the debt of their father. So I might think that there's a mitzvah of chinuch, that these minors have a mitzvah of chinuch, so you should pay back the debt that your father owned. And so Chazal say, no, we don't have chinuch on this. We don't want to drain their account prematurely. When they get older, they'll deal with it. That's one way to look at it. The other way is that, okay, forget about the mitzvah part. There is what's known as a shibud. There is a lien on this portfolio. Mm-hmm. So forget about a mitzvah. This guy demands his money. So those are two ways to kind of look at that. And so the question is, well, where does tzedakah fit in? If you just see it as a mitzvah, so then it becomes a little bit easier. You could just say that we don't want to have there's no mitzvah of chinuch. There's no mitzvah of teaching kids to give tzedakah from their portfolio if they're orphans. Chazal said, we don't want to do that. If you look at it, though, as an obligation, a financial obligation, so then it becomes a little bit trickier. Then you have to involve some sort of based in magic that Beis Din is saying, no, we're making an exception to the rule over here. You do need to give, but we're basically just hitting the brakes on it for some reason that we're intervening. Again, both of those work, but depending on which perspective you have, Beis Din is playing a much more active role in hitting the brakes on draining this account. Okay, yeah.
I'm just wondering about Afilu Yesh Lahem Mamon Habe.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't that thing about putting the brakes on no longer apply if the loan is not going to drain the account, as you said, or diminish it significantly?
So one answer to that is you could say it's sort of a low plug. That Beis Din basically said, look, if we make this an exception, then I don't want to make an exception over there, so we're just making a blanket rule that no. The other is that, maybe if we're talking about like a dollar.
I mean, if they have a trust fund of $1 million and the loan is for $1,000.
So there the rationale is that the kids should have the right and opportunity to go through the accounts themselves. I heard this from Rav Schachter, that basically we want, I don't know if it's in a Gemara anywhere, but basically, like, I think maybe it might be Rashbam, one of the commentaries, basically saying that, like, we want the kids to have the opportunity to go through the documents. Uh-huh. And not only have the opportunity to go through them, but to understand them. When they become mature adults, so then they'll go through, they'll see the loan documents, they'll see the bank statements, and if they see that it's not paid up, so they'll return it. If you go to an 8-year-old and say, your dad owed me money, so yeah, I have a guardian that's making sure I'm not getting scammed, mm-hmm. but Chazal wanted the kids themselves to be able to look at the statements, understand what's going on, and do it.
Or you could also say, if you look at it from the mitzvah perspective, there's no mitzvah on,
right.
young little kids.
Yeah.
Right. So that's from the financial end. If you look at it from the mitzvah, you just say, yeah, there's no mitzvah chinuch. There's no.
It's not even a question of chinuch. It's no mitzvah to return the money.
Right. Exactly.
At this point.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't clarify that. Meaning they don't have any mitzvah right now whatsoever.
Right.
Exactly. Right. Okay. So where do we get this from? So where do we get this idea of forcing normal people to give tzedakah, or in a normal financial situation? So let's turn now to the Gemara. So we're in Bava Basra. This is the first perek. Now, as I said last week, the first perek of Bava Basra, it talks about, the title of the perek is Hashutfin, partners. So it talks about generally neighbors and the rights and privileges that neighbors have on their neighbor, on their other neighbor. So if I decide that I want to build a wall between our two properties, can I force you to chip in? And how much can I force you to chip in? Or let's say we have a wall and it's beginning to deteriorate. Can I force you to help me with the cost of repairs? Can you have trees or holes or trenches or fields near my property line because it might be weakening the structural integrity of my house or my field. Mm-hmm. So there's all these rights and demands. One of the last Mishnayos in the first parak of Bava Basra broadens out from just immediate neighbors and goes to townsfolk in general. Basically, the rights and privileges that members of towns or communities can have on members of the community itself. So it goes through a number of things, basically saying that a town has to pave the roads. It has to build walls around it for protection. It has all these services that a community gives. That costs money. So if you're a member of the community, you have to contribute to that. And so the Mishnah asks, how long do you have to live in the city for in order to become obligated in paying those, for lack of a better term, like you said, taxes? So I think in America, for tax purposes, a residency requirement is 6 months, I think, in order to be considered a resident, at least. I don't know, when I moved to Riverdale from New Jersey, my accountant told me that you needed to be here for 6 months in order to file residency in New York. So I don't know, that's what New York is apparently.
You moved to Israel, you're there for 6 months, you don't have residency in New York anymore.
Well,
if you declare it.
That's the thing. I think, people can move from one state to another and not declare.
Right, no, that's true. So that's true. You do have to declare it. So here.
Also, when I worked in Jersey part time, I was filling out two tax returns, New York State, New Jersey return.
Right.
So let's not go with, they weren't that sophisticated in tax. They had a very simple tax rate. You give or we kill.
Okay. All right. So here, what the Gemara and Bava Batra, what the Mishnah says is that it's 12 months. 12 months. If you buy a house, so then it kicks in immediately.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise.
30 days?
I don't think so.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Mezuzah is something else. Meaning, if you buy a house and you move in, so that's.
Oh, and move in.
Meaning, like if you move in, you have to move in. Otherwise, okay. it's not just property. It's that you have to move in there. But if you buy a house as opposed to renting, meaning if you rent, so then you have to be renting for 12 months in order to be obligated in taxes. One of those things listed in the Mishnah is a kupa. Is literally kupa is a box that was tzedakah. So in general, in the times of the Gemara, as we'll see, there were two sort of general communal tzedakah funds. One was the kupa. It was basically a box. People put money in the box, and if somebody needed, they took money from the box. Or the gaboyim would take money from the box and give it to you. That'll maybe the next topic. We'll see the halachos of being a gabay tzedakah. But the
gabay
other
tzedakah.
What
gabay tzedakah?
Yes, gabay tzedakah. Exactly. the other is what was known as a tamchoy. A tamchoy literally means plate, and so that was for basically more short-term acute needs, where instead of money, people would just put food on the plate. And there would be a room, and people could come in and take food. So those are sort of the two things. And so the Gemara asks, how long do you have to be part of the town in order to contribute to those things as well? So now let's look in the Gemara. The Gemara starts off, if you go down to the very wide lines, it's the end of the third very wide line, Va'amar Rav Asi. If you're looking in the English, it is on the second English page, on the right column, halfway down. That's over here, V'amar Rav Asi. So we say, V'amar Rav Asi, Amar Rav Yochanan. Rav Asi says in the name of Rav Yochanan, Hakol lepasei ha'ir. Everybody has to contribute for pasei ha'ir. So what are pasei ha'ir? So the way Art School translates it is boards, which are used to fortify the city. So, again, I don't think it actually means, like, walls, it means it was something that they used to kind of board up either doors or gates, something to reinforce the security of the city. So everybody has to contribute to that. Va'afilu miyasmi, even orphans. So we drain that, we just take from their bank account to protect the city. Avol Rabbanon lo. But rabbis don't have to pay that for that. Why? De Rabbanon lo tzrichei netirusa. Because rabbis don't need protection. They have spiritual protection. Rabbis don't have to pay the defense taxes. Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa says, Lishura ula parsha ula tarzina afilu miyasmi. So what are all these things? So again, let's just look at the English. It's easier than going through Rashi. Rav Papa says, funds for repairing the city wall. Shura is either a line or a wall. That's why we call a shura a line, because it looks like a wall. Liparsha'a, we know that from Megillas Esther. It's a horseman. Ulitarzina are a weapons guard. Meaning, basically, the guy that guards the armory, or who takes care of the armory of the city. So there, again, everybody's got to pay for that, even orphans. Avol Rabbanan lo tzrichi netirusa, but rabbis don't, because they don't need protection. Klala de milsa. This is the general rule. Kol milsa di is luhu hana'amine. Anything that people benefit from, afilu miyasmi. Orphans have to contribute to. since rabbis don't benefit from this protection because they don't need it, they don't have to contribute.
Well, what about some of the other functions of the city?
So that they do.
Repairing the roads.
Yeah, so that they have to. So, okay. I mean, this is talking about the defense bill. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't an omnibus bill. It was just it was different fundings. So rabbis have to pay for, you know, water, for sewage, sanitation. For sanitation, for mm-hmm. streets. Just not for defense.
Okay.
And so the general principle, which we extend to all areas that this Mishnah was talking about, is if you benefit from it, you got to pay for it. If definitionally you don't benefit from it, then you're excused. So now if we go back to that idea that the Shulchan Aruch said about orphans not having to give tzedakah, but they can if they'll have this reputation. So now we can begin to understand that we can even force the orphans to pay for something that they'll be glorified in their reputation for. Why? Because they're benefiting from it in a certain way. And whether we can force Yisomim to give when it's in their benefit, I don't want to get into. I'm just saying, if you believe that that's true, this is where it would come from. Now the Gemara, now we get into tzedakah. I believe. Afilu miyasmi. So, Rabba Rama Tzedakah Ayasmi. So, Rabba levied Tzedakah on Yisomim. Adive Bar Merion. They were orphans from the Bar Merion family. Amar Le Abaye. So, Abaye asked him, Vahatani Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Ein Poskin Tzedakah Al HaYisomim, Afilu Lepidyon Shvuyin. We don't levy taxes, we don't levy tzedakah on orphans, even for pidyon shvuyin. So now we come to it. Amar le, ana l'achshavina ka'avdi. So this is what I was just saying, that I am doing it for their own benefit, to make them chashav. I'm doing it to make them look good. So that's where this idea comes from. Again, that's the traditional understanding. There are other interpretations. Ifre hormuz, ime dishvur malka. So this name comes up a couple of times in the Gemara. Very interesting people, a Persian king. So the Talmud Bavli was written in Bavel. It was controlled by the Persians, the Sasanian Empire. And so this was one of the kings of the Sasanian Empire, Shvor Malka. People have tried to actually pin down who it was on the Sasanian kings list. I don't know if they've been so successful, but apparently a figure. He had a mom named Ifra Hormuz. And so what did she do? Shadra Arnica de Dinare Lekame de Rav Yosef. So she sent a purse of gold coins to Rav Yosef. Amra, and she said, Lehave Lemitzvah Rabba. So you should do a big mitzvah with it. You know, somebody, it's like when you have a foundation and they give it to somebody saying, we believe in you, do something good with this thing. The discretionary fund. So Yosef Rav Yosef, V'kama ayin ba. So Rav Yosef was thinking, my mitzvah rabba, what's this big thing that I should do with it? Amar le Abaye, miditani Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda, ein poskin tzedakah al hayisomim, afilu lepidyon shvuyin. Since we know that we don't levy tzedakah on orphans, even for pidyon shvuyin, shma mina, we can learn from there, pidyon shvuyin mitzvah rabbahi. So it must be that pidyon shvuyin is a great mitzvah. Meaning we're saying even for something as great as pidyon shvuyin, we don't tax yisomim for tzedakah. But that implies that pidyon shvuyin is a good thing. And the Gemara continues. I don't think we need to go into all of this, to be honest, because it's just going back and forth about pidyon shvuyin. So we'll skip down. In the Gemara, we'll skip down to the Tanu Rabbanan. Those are the first words on the page. If you're in the English, it is on the third page, the bottom over here. Tanu Rabbanan Kupa Shel Tzedaka. So the Gemara continues. One second, let me get back here. I'll just read it over here. So Tanu Rabbanan Kupa Shel Tzedaka Nigvis Bishnayim is collected with two people. Umischalekes bishlosha, and it's distributed by three people. Nigvis bishnayim, it's collected by two. She'ein osin sraros al hatzibur pachos mishnayim, because we don't give people authority over the public as one person. Power has to be shared. That you can't put anybody in executive power. There needs to be somebody else to balance them out. So just before, we'll get into this when we get into the sugya, the topic of gabayim, but just very generally, srara means authority. So why is this a position of authority?
What, to take the money? It's
yeah.
So because, you're taking the person's money.
Okay. So the ability to seize assets is a general rule. The way we define srara, it is definitionally the ability to make people do stuff with their money, to tell people what to do with their money. That's how in halacha we define it. So then the question is, so a beis din. So why is a beis din considered to be a position of srara? For that reason, because they paskin. I want you to give your money to him.
Well, hefker beis din beis.
Right, and exactly. And beis din can literally go down and seize assets. So is a shul president a position of srara? Is a shul president a position of authority? What would you say?
There's only one, so... a shul board is a different story.
Or an executive board.
Executive board is a different story.
Yeah, so if you can make unilateral decisions about finances, not just deciding, you know, I want, you know, the picnic to be here versus the shul dinner to be here, but if it divines unilateral financial decisions, that's when srara kicks in. This had ramifications. The American Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. There was this organization.
Yeah, yeah.
At one point, I think in the 70s, they appointed a woman as their president. So Rabbi Tendler was a member of the association. His father-in-law was Rav Moshe. Yeah. So they asked Rav Moshe, saying, how can you have this woman as a president? That's a position of authority.
Mm-hmm.
Women should not be in positions of authority, according to halacha.
Right.
So Rav Moshe said, reportedly, and he wrote a tshuva. I don't think the tshuva was about that particular topic, but he reiterates this in multiple places. That is not a srara. That's not authority. That's avdus. That's slavery. That's how he defined it. And he said the difference is that in that type of a position, she's not making financial decisions. She's just the one deciding, okay, we're going to have the conference here. You know, he's going to speak. She's going to speak. He's not going to talk. We're going to use this kind of cardstock. She was doing that anyway, and so nobody wanted to have all that work. So they nominated her as president, and that's why she's doing it. So that... There are other people that disagree and say any type of authority and power is a problem. The way Rav Moshe, I think the way most people understand it, is that it has to be the ability to make unilateral significant. Again, it can't be like, you know, I like blue and the blue paper costs a dollar more than the green paper. But very significant financial decisions, that's when the real definition of srara comes in. So just something to keep in mind.
Talking about Jewel,
yeah.
RJC, there was a whole issue about can you have a woman president?
Right.
And so one of the things they decided to do was to make what's called the executive board.
Right.
So it's shared amongst...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's why there's no issue. That's why we wouldn't define the position of president as srara, meaning they do have some executive power,
mm-hmm.
but they can't do everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming they can't. I haven't read the Constitution, but I'm assuming they can't. And we have an executive board for a reason, and it's not a legal fiction.
No, it's not a legal fiction.
Okay.
It's fiction. I don't know. I haven't been on the board in many years.
Okay.
Okay.
One second.
I said that I'm supposed to be the one in charge of home. My wife tells me we're...
That's a whole separate issue. That's not Swara. That's...
Abdus.
No, it's Abdus. You're the
editor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, whatever happens in the base medrash stays in the base.
Of course. So, Now, I said we're going to skip. I do, though. There is a part which, unfortunately, I didn't get that page photocopied. I apologize. If you turn back, though, to the Gemara, yeah, on Ches Amud Beis, so the second page of Gemara, so if you go down to right before the lines get wide, so go one, yeah, one line up. So Rav Nachman Amar Rabba Baravua Lefi Shemimashkinin Al Hatzedaka Va'afilu Be'erev Shabbos. So this was a line about the Gabayim, that the Gabayim can come in and take a collateral even on Erev Shabbos when you're kind of busy, to make sure you give tzedakah. So the Gemara asks, Inni, is that so? V'haksiv. There's a pasuk that says, Ufakadati Al Kol Lochatzav. I'm going to pay back all the people that oppress my nation, God says. For Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Martha, that was her name. That was his mother's name. Why he's named after, why he's identified based on his mother is interesting. I don't know the reason. Mishmei de Rav, in the name of Rav. Va'afilu al gabei tzedakah. God is even going to punish the gabayim of tzedakah for bullying people into giving money. He says, how can you do that? Lokashia, ha de amid, ha de lo amid. God's only going to punish the gabayim of tzedakah if they just basically shake somebody down. But if there's been a determination by an authority that they're able to contribute more and they're not, so that's okay, that's their job. Then it gives a story. Ki ha de rava ach pele rav nasan bar ami. Like what Rava did forcibly to Rav Nasan Bar Ami, v'shakel minei arba mea zuze litzdaka. He shook him down. He forced him to give 400 zuz for tzedakah, which is basically approximately a year's salary for a...
2 years.
Oh, is 200?
Well, the... Ksuba.
Right, Ksuba is 200. Oh, no, you're right. Yeah, I'm sorry, I multiplied it by two. You're right, yeah.
So it's
2 years' salary of a low-class worker. Meaning, mm-hmm, basically the bare minimum you need to survive, right. 2 years' salary. So not an insignificant, mm-hmm, sum. Okay, so we'll stop there. And basically you're saying he was able to do that. Why? Because he realized, okay, he could give more, and he's not, so I'm telling him to give more, right, and I'm making him give more. So everything that we read so far, if you had to pick what from this Gemara is a proof that you can force somebody to give tzedakah. So I think it's pretty obvious that this last story that we read counts. Is there anything else that we read that you believe would support that? There doesn't have to be. I'm just saying. Like, is there anything else that might? So some of the Rishonim do. So if you turn back to the Shulchan Aruch, you look at the Bir Hagra. So the Vilna Gaon wrote a very, very terse commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, basically giving you what he believed were the sources for the decisions. So if you have the Shulchan Aruch, right under it is the Bir Hagra. So we do the first one. It says, based in Kofin, based in Kinfor, so where do we know that? Harif v'harash, the Rif and Rush say this, Amasha Kosov, on what it says, Bavabasra Ches Amud Aleph. It's referring to Bavabasra Ches Amud Aleph Litamchoi, Lepasei Ha'ir, that people have to contribute for the plate and for the boards of a city. Upasei Ha'ir, Tnan b'masnisin sham de kofin, and the Mishnah says that we can force people to contribute to pay for the security of the town. Visham, and then it also says ki hadirava, that story that we just read about Rava forcing Rav Nachman to pay 400 zuz. So the Rif and Rush actually say there are two sources in our Gemara. The more obvious one is the fact that Rava forced people to pay up. He said, you can give more, I'm forcing you to give more. But he actually says the very beginning of our sugya about who has to contribute actually is a source as well. If you turn now, after the Gemaras that I photocopied, what I have is the tour. So the way that halacha developed, the Rosh's son was he wrote the tour. The tour is this middle text, and that's basically an anthology of Rishonim's opinions on a halachic topic. And then on the side, you have the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef was the author of the Shulchan Aruch, and he basically provided more sources and more details and more discussion on what happened. So,
and then eventually he wrote the Shulchan Aruch.
Right, and then eventually he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. The interesting question, or like what people like to study, is how much carries over from the Beis Yosef to the Shulchan Aruch. Sometimes it's, you know, word for word. Sometimes it's not, and that's where it gets interesting. Mm-hmm. But for
he also takes the Rambam.
Yes, so what he takes from the Rambam, as a general rule, if you find just a strange wording in the Shulchan Aruch, your go-to should be, let me see how the Rambam phrased it. The Beis Yosef, or Rav Yosef Kara, when he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, used the text of the Rambam as a template for the halacha, and he changed things when he believed the halacha was different. That's linguistically. Opinion-wise, I don't think it necessarily carries, I think then a lot of it is more analogous to the Beis Yosef. It's more like textual words and phraseology that he gets from the Rambam. So let's see now, if you turn to the second page of the tour that I photocopied. So the top left column is the Beis Yosef, and this is him quoting the Rif and the Rush. Shaminan, we learn from here, De kol hani mili chiyuva. All of those things listed in the Mishnah, all of those public services, including the communal tzedakah funds, chiyuva, are an obligation. Umafkinan minei, and we can forcibly take money from people to pay for it. Dumya de pasei ha'ir. Similar to the case that the Gemara explicitly says, basically forcing people to pay up for the boards to protect the city. Vigarsinan Ocham, and we also learn there, Ubeperek Narish and Ispatata, and also in Ksubis, Rava Akafye Li Rav Nasan Barami, Vaafik Mine, Arbaz Meya Zuz Litzdaka, Umukim Lahasam Bidda Amid. And so we have that story where Rava forced people to pay up when he thought they could give more, when he knew they could give more. So we're going to see that Tosas is going to have a question about how Beis Din is authorized to force people to pay up. Why do you think that second story wasn't enough? Meaning that story pretty much says it very clearly. Why do you think that, I mean, it could be that they didn't need to and we just decided to because technically it supports our argument, but why do you think we would want to bring in that other proof from the fact that we force people to pay for defense bills, when we force people to pay for sewer systems, we can also force people to pay for tzedakah. Why would we want to bring that as a proof? What does that add?
Put tzedakah at a higher level of importance.
How so?
Well, you're living in a community. You gotta have defense. We saw what happens when it fails.
Right.
You gotta have
public services.
Public services. And we see where our charities have fallen apart in the city. You got to have charities. And hence, they're all like on the same level because for the common good, so as to speak.
Yeah, exactly. What we could have just read the second story of Rava forcing people to pay up is that, yeah, he saw this poor person. Nebuch, there's this poor guy, he's collecting money. And he's like, okay, this guy needs money. I know that Rav Nachman's got a lot of money. So as a member of Beis Din, I'm going to force him to give some of his money to this other guy. I could have understood it that way. As we'll see when we get more halacha l'maisa and we learn a lot of the achronim, that's not how it works, or that's not how they understand that it works. Rather, I don't force you to give to individuals. I force you to contribute to the community's general chesed fund. Why? Because that is a public service. Just like I can tax you, just like I can force you to pay for other things that you benefit from, mm-hmm. In a certain sense, Rav Soloveitchik talks about this in a more philosophical way about tzedakah, that you benefit from being part of a community. So in a certain sense, this is a public good. A public good is something that you have to pay for. And so that's why I'm forcing you to pay for tzedakah.
Also, if you go back to the 13, whatever it is, number of tzedakah.
Yeah.
It's better that neither the recipient or the contributor know, the contributor doesn't know where the money is going, and the recipient doesn't know where it came from, except from a general fund, in order to maintain a community's morale, a community's feeling towards each other. I don't know that the person over there is getting, and that person doesn't know that I'm the one who's giving. He has no obligations to me, and I have no obligations to him.
Exactly, yeah. So aside from it being maybe more economically efficient or more, equitable, it also is important for the morale of both the ani, the poor person, as well as the people that are giving. It maintains respect. So keep this all in mind, and this is the last point we're going to talk about. We're going to see Tosfos. So if you go back to the Gemara, Ches Amud Beis, so the second page of Gemara, so Tosfos, both here and in Ksubas, and in Chulin, asks a question about our story about Rava forcing Rav Nassan to pay up money for tzedakah. So the Tosfos is the 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth Tosfos. It's the one in the middle of the page with the Dibur HaMaschil Achfei l'Rav Nassan, that he forced Rav Nassan. So Tosfos asks, V'im Tomar, if you'll ask, V'habeperek kol habasar, we learned in Maseches Chulin in the chapter of kol habasar, Omar, we say over there, kol mitzvos asei, shematan schara ksuva bitzida, any positive mitzvah in the Torah whose reward is stated explicitly in the Torah, ein based in shalmata musharin aleha. Based in is not charged with forcing compliance for those things. V'gabei tzedakah, and by tzedakah it says, ki pasach tiftach es yad chalau, you should open your hand to the poor person, uksiv, and it says, ki biglal hadavar hazeh yivarechacha, and because of that, God will bless you. So Tosfos asks that we have a positive mitzvah, and again, this is where we bring in last week's stuff, we talked about what the mitzvahs are. So at the very least, there's a positive mitzvah to give tzedakah, and afterwards it says, God's blessing you because you're giving. So how can Beis Din force you to give? So we'll see the first answer. V'omer Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam says, D'hai kfiya bedvarim. Nah, it doesn't mean that he physically shook him down. It's that he convinced him, quote unquote.
I have my Italian buddy's picture.
Exactly.
If you like, you want to keep your knees in good shape.
Yeah, so basically he's, he talked to him. He made him an offer he can't refuse. Exactly. So now, and he brings a proof where it says that, kfiya doesn't mean literal physical force. It means just talking. Dehai kfiya bedvarim kimo kafye ve'al perech narashin espatata. Okay, so he brings another source. Ve'od tiris. He gives another answer. Dehacha kiblu aleihem sheyichofu osan hagava. That the people in that town accepted on themselves that the gabbai can shake them down. Meaning when you move into the town, the understanding is that the gabbai can shake you down. So that's the second answer. Third answer. L'ri nira, the ri gives another answer. D'bitztaka kofin mishum d'isbuhu lav. There's also a mitzvah lo saseh. There's also a negative commandment. D'chsiv ba lo sa'ameitz es levavcha v'lo sa'kpoz. Don't close off your heart and hand. So right now we saw three answers. We'll see more next time. But the three answers are, he didn't actually force him. The second is, everybody seems to be okay with force. And the third answer is that there's also a negative mitzvah. So what about the other two? So this third answer was the re. So Rabbeinu Tam doesn't think there's a negative mitzvah. We'll get into that another time. There are other, we'll see, there are about six or seven answers to this question. Some of them more fundamental, some of them more technical. There are later answers, though, and this is where we'll see them inside, but I want to use that as a foil to what we just learned. The Ketzos, the Mishnah LeMelech, and Rav Salvechik, and many others have basically said that we have to keep in mind that tzedakah is a mitzvah, but it's also a financial obligation. And so it's a debt. I owe this person, or I owe the community, money. And so I can come in and seize it because there's a lien on my property. So based on what we were seeing from here, what we were seeing from the beginning of the Gemara, that source that the Rush and the Rifs use, that it's basically part of taxing, so that's when I can be kofa people. That's when I can force people, not because everybody just agrees to it. I don't have to agree to pay tzedakah. I don't even have to agree to be bullied by a gabbai. It's me moving in basically means if you want to move in here, this is part of taxing. So it's not what I would call a shibud in the classical sense, meaning it's not like, oh, I owe somebody money. It's not that like, oh, you know, it's really the poor person's money. That's not how, some people argue that. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's accurate. Uh-huh. It's your money. God wants you to give it to them. Maybe on a more hashkafic sense, it's not your money. But legally, it's your money. Mm-hmm. But just like you have to pay taxes for things, this is also a tax. Tzedakah is a tax. It's a tax that's used for public social services to pay for people. Mm-hmm. So that's why Rava could force Rav Nassan to pay up. Not because, you know, it was a negative mitzvah, not because everybody was okay with it, and not even because it was the poor person's money. It was his money. But when you move into this community, you pay taxes. These are taxes. So that's where I wanna leave us with. But if that's the case, what that means then is that forget about individuals can't force you to pay tzedakah. It also means that even Beis Din can't force you to pay to independent individual causes. So, you know, the shul was raising money to Magen David Adom right now. So the shul can't force you to donate to Magen David Adom. They can't. Why? Because that's not a public service. I mean, that's not a public service. If there was Magen David Adom here, that would be one thing. But just giving it to Eretz Yisrael, that's not something they could force you to do. If they would say, though, that we are choosing to allocate a percentage of money from our Chesed fund to Magen David Adom, oh, and by the way, we need you to up your contributions to the Chesed fund by 20% right now, that they could force you to do. So again, it's semantics in that case, but that actually does happen a lot, meaning, you know, guys that come collecting with a te'udah from your local vod, like I know in Teaneck, they come with a te'udah from the vod, basically saying, you know, we can give tzedakah. They can't shake you down. They can't say that, oh, the town is forcing you to give me money. But the town can say, we're establishing a fund to pay these people, and you have to contribute to that. Just interesting way to keep it in mind. So we've begun to study the topic of kofin on staka, and God willing, we'll see a number of other answers and ways to look at it over the next few times. All right.